Well, good evening. It's good to be here with you. Right, in the first part of the evening, we're going to be talking a little bit about the appeal of the Da Vinci Code, what makes it so popular, and then we're going to be talking a little bit about some of the problems with it. There are a number of reasons for its appeal. Firstly, it's a page-turner of a novel. It's a great, fun story. It's not the height of literary excellence, but it is a fun story. It's a murder mystery, it's an adventure, it's a thriller. It's full of cliffhangers, 105 chapters plus prologue and epilogue, and almost every one of them ends in a cliffhanger. So it's an exciting, very exciting story. It's full of mystery and suspense, with puzzles and codes, cover-ups, secrets, lies, all that kind of stuff that makes it very mysterious and full of suspense. There are many enigmas and riddles within it, many dead ends and red herrings, not least Bishop Aringa Rosa, which means red herring. As well as being exciting and mysterious, it is a very anti-establishment novel as well in many ways. We've lost confidence within our society in any authorities. We live through an age of successive political scandals. All my life I've been hearing about political scandals from the time I first remember hearing about Watergate on the radio as a kid. It's not only politics that we've lost confidence in, but all kinds of authorities. There's no confidence in Western culture. But we do live in a culture which loves sensationalist tabloid journalism, and those kinds of exposés of the establishment and the problems within it, the cover-ups within it, and so on. Closely related to that is the fact that people love conspiracy theories. Perhaps the greatest conspiracy theory ever is still who killed JFK, still being talked about 40-odd years later. But the Roswell incident, Area 51, and all those kinds of things. Even though some of the people who perpetrate these conspiracy theory hoaxes stand up and say, it was just a joke. Nobody believes them because the conspiracy theory just takes hold and it has a life of its own. Think about crop circles and people saying, we started doing crop circles, it was us. And nobody believes them. So it feeds on all of that kind of stuff. Dan Brown denies being a conspiracy theorist, but he is rather like Robert Langdon in many ways. Langdon viewed the world as a web of profoundly intertwined histories and events. The connections may be invisible, but they are always there, buried just beneath the surface. They're Dan Brown's italics. And that's the way that Dan Brown thinks himself. All of these connections in all kinds of odd places, things that aren't obviously, maybe not really, connected at all, but he finds a way of stringing them together, just like Robert Langdon does. Another aspect of this anti-establishment side of things is that we do live in a culture which is very distrustful of received truth, received wisdom. We've lived through a massive cultural shift within Western society, from a culture which primarily values objectivity to one which stresses subjectivity. Coming along with that has come a growing disdain for any belief systems that claim to be explaining everything and anything, an overarching system of belief or of thought. And so Western culture, by and large, has rejected the great systems of Christianity, Marxism, even old-fashioned atheism to a large extent. Islam, any big system of thought is distrusted in the Western world. Another facet of this is that people have become very suspicious of any things which are claiming to be true. We assume that they're attempts to manipulate us or to have power over us. These are the kinds of things that the writers in the area of postmodernism have written on extensively in recent decades. These are strong features of our culture. And Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code, is so exciting, but it trades on all of these. It fuels our distrust of authority. It fuels our suspicion about truth. It is also a rejection of religion itself, or at least that old-time religion. Anything traditional, historical, orthodox in the way of religion has been rejected by this novel. Dan Brown denies this. He says this book is not anti-anything. It's a novel. Well, yes, it is a novel. But if he didn't say the same kinds of things in his interviews as the novel says, then maybe we'd let him get away with that statement. But when in interviews he says he believes the history in this, that if he was writing a non-fiction book, he wouldn't change any of the historical content in it, then it's more than just a novel. We do live in an age which is cynical about traditional Orthodox historical Christianity as it's been practiced for 2,000 years, the best part of 2,000 years. But we do live in a time where people are very cynical about it. They've turned their back on it to a very large extent. Instead, plenty of attention is given to some of the shameful periods of church history, and not without some justification. Dan Brown particularly points to the witch trials and to the suppression of women. And it has to be said that the church's track record down through history has not always been one of a glowing report, clean sheet. There are many things for which the Christian church has to be ashamed, though Dan Brown does rather overplay it. He's not the only one, of course. But it does mean that we feel that the church in general is steeped in hypocrisy, and many people don't want to go anywhere near it. Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code trade on that to a very large extent. Here's the Ian McKellen character in the film, Sir Lee Teabing, saying, "For 2,000 years the church has rained oppression and atrocity on mankind, crushed passion and idea alike, all in the name of that walking God. Proof of Jesus' mortality will put an end to all that suffering, drive this church of lies to its knees. The living heir must be revealed. Jesus must be shown for what he was, not miraculous, simply man. The dark con must be exposed. Mankind can finally be set free, and we can do it, Robert." That sounds to me like it's a bit anti-church. Or in the book, where Lee Teabing says almost everything our fathers have taught us about Christ is false. But while it's a denial of established religion, a rejection of that, it is not a rejection of spirituality. And this, for me, is the biggest single attraction of this book in our world. Why has it sold such astronomical numbers of copies? Despite what some reports tell you, it hasn't sold more than Harry Potter. Harry Potter, the last copy of Harry Potter, sold more on the first day than Dan Brown sold in the whole year. Incidentally, 1,000 copies of Da Vinci Code got left on Eurostar last year. 1,000 copies got left behind. Isn't that extraordinary? I'll let you read into that whatever you like. Anyway, but one of the key reasons of its appeal is the fact that it does have spirituality right at the core. And while we say that we're not religious in our culture very often, people do say again and again, "But I am spiritual." We long for spirituality as long as it's the right sort. We want mysterious, non-challenging ideas. The more esoteric and mysterious they are, the better, it seems. That's what we long for. That's what the Da Vinci Code offers. The impact of feminism on Western culture makes his focus on the sacred feminine and goddess spirituality extremely attractive. I want to spend a few minutes talking about that in a second. One of the really positive things this book has done is to encourage people to talk about these kinds of ideas. Dan Brown says, "My hope in writing this novel was that the story would serve as a catalyst and a springboard for people to discuss the important topics of faith, religion, and history." Well, it's certainly done that. Here we are. We are evidence of the fact that, you know, we wanted to come here this evening. Well, I had no choice, I suppose, but you wanted to come here this evening because there's something to be talked about here. He's provoked people into talking about some big issues. That's fabulous. There's been more discussion about the reliability of the Bible, how did the Bible come into existence, and all those kinds of things in the last couple of years than I can ever remember before in general culture. Dan Brown himself describes himself as a spiritual seeker. He says, "I really wish I had the luxury of absolute, unquestioning faith. I do not. And I'm still searching. I wrote this novel as part of my own spiritual quest." He's still on a journey. He hasn't arrived yet, but he is, in his mind, a spiritual seeker. You have to take what he says about the luxury of absolute, unquestioning faith with a little pinch of salt, because elsewhere he's quite clear that those people who do seem to have absolute, unquestioning faith are not the people he thinks are humble in their thinking. He clearly sees there's a degree of arrogance with that. So on the one hand, he longs to have that certainty, but on the other hand, he doesn't actually think it's a good thing. Here is Darrell Bock, one of the many people who've gone into print writing about the Da Vinci Code. Darrell Bock is a New Testament specialist and historian of the early years of the Christian church. And he describes what made him go into print with his book. He says, the key was when I heard Dan Brown on national television say that if he were writing non-fiction, he would not change a thing about the history. Not only that, but he said he had heavily researched his work and had become a believer in these views. Dan Brown may say, I don't have the luxury of absolute unquestioning faith, but he does believe the things that he's put into his novel. One of the central things is this business about the Holy Grail. It is the central thing, of course, the quest for the Holy Grail. The central idea of it all is that the traditional Christian understanding of Jesus is wrong. Everything our fathers have taught us about Christ is wrong. Jesus was, in fact, he says, married to Mary Magdalene. They had a child called Sarah. Mary and Sarah went to live in France after the crucifixion. And he says that the bloodline of Jesus and Mary live on. This is the true Holy Grail. If you've read the novel, seen the film, you'll know about the wordplay that goes on there, how sangreal can mean either Holy Blood or Holy Grail. And Dan Brown has taken this from a book called The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail by three gentlemen by the names of Michael Bagent, Richard Lee and Henry Lincoln, two of whom you might have noticed sued Dan Brown earlier in the year for plagiarism, though Henry Lincoln stayed very quiet on it all.